This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As a person, as a father of three, I'm a lot more worried about abrupt climate change than the gradual climate change. Not that I'm not worried about 2 or 2.5 degrees in 100 years. But I'm very worried about the abrupt climate change, because in a densely populated planet, abrupt climate change can have a very large regional impact. And if that region is heavily populated, that will cause geopolitical implications beyond what I would like to imagine.
Abrupt climate change, where regions heat up 10 degrees or more, struck dozens of times in the last million years. Conditions are developing that could bring unimaginable changes in less than a lifetime. From Copenhagen, Dr. Sune Olander Rasmussen explains the risks. Plus, climate change will rob deep ocean life of oxygen for centuries, even if we stop emitting greenhouse gases. From Geomar at the Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research, Dr. Andreas Oschlies takes us on a tour of the deep and its future. A stunning abrupt climate shift is possible. During the last ice age, temperatures in Greenland heated up anywhere from 5 to 16 degrees Celsius in decades. That is up to 28 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. The Arctic is already warming beyond anything seen by modern humans, and last year Arctic sea ice levels, well, they were the second lowest ever recorded. Are we rushing toward that tipping point now? Our guest is Dr. Sune Olander Rasmussen, Distinguished Associate Professor at the Center for Ice and Climate in Denmark's Niels Bohr Institute. He's co-author of the new paper published in Nature Communications April 8, 2021, The Anatomy of Past Abrupt Warmings Recorded in Greenland Ice. From Copenhagen, Denmark, Sune, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we get to the causes of such big changes, which we all want to know, what would one of these abrupt climate shifts around Greenland and the North Atlantic look like?
That's a pretty good question that a lot of people are working on. First of all, these shifts happen from the full glacial state. So we're starting off from a point which is massively colder than today. So we're in the central part of the glacial period, where large parts of North America and Canada and Scandinavia were covered but with ice sheets. And then we see an abrupt climate change, which happens in sometimes a few decades, even maybe less than that, up to a century or two, during which a number of features of the climate system change more or less together. The sea ice changed very dramatically from a state where there was sea ice far into the North Atlantic. We have temperature changes, as you said, from 5 to 16 degrees. And we had a change in circulation pattern, all happening together. This is what the paper is investigating, is how these different factors of climate, how they change and how they relate to each other.
And in the timeline in your new paper, we see sudden variations of Greenland temperatures in the period between 30 and 50,000 years ago. And we have not had such a rapid shift in the Arctic during the last 10,000 years. Do we know why the climate has been so stable? And are we due for a big Greenland warming anyway?
This is what everybody wants to know. We can't really answer that question yet. This is a study that helps us understand the nature of these climate shifts, the mechanisms involved. And hopefully this will help us be able to predict or evaluate the risk of us going into a similar situation. Again, similar in the sense that we're not in a glacial now, so we can't have the same type of climate change that we had in the past. Well, we can still have an abrupt climate change, which involves some of the same mechanisms. So changes in circulation patterns, in sea ice, in temperature. So this is what we're worried about. This is why we, apart from just being curious, this is why we're so interested in these past climate changes, because there are many of them. There are about 30, depending on how you count them, during the glacial. They were most pronounced and most regular during the central part of the glacial from 60 to 30,000 years ago. But we have enough of them to be able to kind of study them and say, is there a typical pattern? Because often we only have a few instances of climate change, and it's very hard to derive the general picture from just a few cases. And what we set out to do here was to say, okay, can we analyze these repeated climate changes and find out whether there is kind of a fingerprint? And that fingerprint would then serve as a kind of as a warning sign if we see the same fingerprint today. So that's what we set out to do. What we then found was that the climate changes, even though it's the same parameters that change, the order, when you look at the really fine details, the order of when these different parts of the climate system changed is different from time to time. They all change from one level to another, but they do it in slightly different ways. And this leads us to conclude that most likely these processes are so closely entangled that if one of them changes, the rest of them change too. And that is worrying also in a modern climate scenario because, as you say, sea ice is changing today. Sea ice has been changing over the last decades. And this is one of the factors that changed in the past. And we're yet not able to say if this means that it can set off a similar set of events in the future. But it's definitely a step in understanding the mechanisms behind it.
Well, this is one of the frustrating things a little about your paper, and must have been for you as scientists, is that the human mind wants a nice linear progression. Well, the sea ice goes out, and then the ocean currents weaken, and then this happens, and then that happens. But here we find something more like instruments in an orchestra playing in concert, and they apparently can come up in different order.
I mean, as I said, we set out to find the archetypical climate change in terms of, you know, we used the analogy of dominoes, you know. So which pieces are involved and in which order do they topple over? And so and which dominoes will topple over which? So like the idea of there being a trigger, the first domino that started to tip, and then the rest would follow suit. And what we found was that it's the same dominoes every time, but they're lined up in a little bit different way every time. So it's not the same one that starts to topple. Eventually they all fall, and this is where the domino analogy breaks down, because every time before the first one has fallen all the way down and it's on the table, all the other ones have started falling too. So it's not that one sets off everything, and then once that is completed, something else happens. Different which one starts, but they all change together. And this is what, in a way, is both very intriguing and also a little bit worrying, because it indicates that the processes are so closely intertwined or entangled that you can't change one without the others.
So when temperatures around Greenland shot up around 12 degrees C or more, about 21 degrees Fahrenheit, was that an isolated regional event, or did it affect weather and climate around the world? I believe you co-authored a paper about that last year in the journal Science.
There are many types of climate change, and this, it's pretty important to understand that this is these Dansker events, as they're called, these abrupt climate changes in Greenland. They are related to a change in the distribution of heat around the globe, more than a change of the mean temperature. So when Greenland gets a lot of warm air, then that heat is being transported from somewhere else. It also changes very on a much smaller scale the average temperature on Earth, but the regional impact is much, much bigger than the global impact. So while when Greenland goes into one of these warm phases, Antarctica starts to cool very slowly, and as long as Greenland is in the warm phase, heat is being tapped away from the southern hemisphere, and Antarctica, where we have also had ice cores, we can do similar analysis, is slowly cooling. So we call it the bipolar seesaw, because it's the two ends of the seesaw. We can't really compare this with global warming, or we can also not compare it with the deglaciation when Earth went from deep freeze into the current interglacial, because this was a more or less a globally homogeneous change. Not that everybody saw the same change, but the direction was roughly the same everywhere. In these climate changes, heat is being moved around on Earth in a different way than it used to be. So it's more like a conveyor belt kind of change.
Still, one could only fear what the effects on fish and on agriculture and on living species of all kinds might be when their regional climates go through big changes within a couple of decades. You can't evolve fast enough to deal with that.
Exactly. And this is, I mean, on a broader picture, this is something that I think worries me and a lot of other climate researchers, is that we tend to talk about global climate change, but nobody lives in the global climate. We all live in local climates. And the effect of global climate change is very likely that some regions will experience much stronger and more abrupt climate changes than the global average. And the people living in those regions will have to adapt or move. And those adaptations can be hard to do because change can be relatively strong compared to these. We see these curves from the IPCC or from other efforts to do, you know, the best projections we can of what's going to happen in the future. These curves are always very smooth. And we tend to discuss the amplitude of these. You know, do we want to invest heavily in measures that can reduce the warming so we stay below 1.5 or 2 degrees, or, you know, whatever target? It's always, you know, it's a smooth curve that we want to keep below a certain cap. But if we get anything like the changes we saw in the past, then the local changes or the regional changes are going to be a lot bigger than that. And it doesn't help you much if you live in an area that suddenly gets much, much warmer, that somebody else is having a cooler time. So it's not always the average that matters. And these changes were very abrupt. And even though we don't think we will get exactly the same because these were from a glacial state to begin with, we can still worry that the same mechanisms can induce climate change, which is strong enough and abrupt enough to really be a problem. And we don't really, but that's the whole problem about climate change. It's extremely hard to predict. We don't even talk about prediction. We talk about if we're really good, we may get to a point where we can assess the risk. Not say when it will happen, but just say what the risk of it happening within a certain time frame would be. That would in itself be a big step forward. And this is what we're working on. And I sometimes think this agenda gets tucked away a little bit in the back compared to the argument about, you know, keeping average temperature or average climate change below a certain threshold, because the local regional impact can be a lot stronger than that.
Well, I totally agree with you. Now, what are the factors that you did look at? I mean, we have Arctic sea ice, we have global temperatures. What were the dominoes, so to speak?
We rely on what's called proxy data because we can't measure past temperatures directly. So we rely on what we can measure in ice cores, and then we can transfer that or to something you really want to know. So this is why it's called proxy data. And so in terms of temperature, we have isotopes of the ice core that can tell us what the temperature was. We have the calcium and the dust content of the ice core that tells us something about how efficient the atmosphere is at transporting impurities from Asia to Greenland. So it's related to the storminess of the atmosphere and also to the amount of dust available, which will rely mainly on the wind and the dryness of the areas where the dust comes from. Then we have sodium, which at least to some degree tells us something about sea ice, probably other factors too. So these are all, you know, all proxies that we can derive from the ice core. We also have the layer thickness, which will tell us simply how much snow fell in Greenland. So these are all indirect measures. What we then did was to see if we could make sense of this, was to run a climate model that will produce, you know, the direct observables that we're really interested in, and then compare how the model version of reality looked relative to our data. And that was a very good correspondence. So we think we have some backing in interpreting the data from the ice core the way we do.
So you did cross-check your ice core data against a climate model?
Cross-check. I mean, we cross-checked two ice cores against each other to make sure that these were not just local flukes that we were interpreting, that they represent a regional climate signal. And then in interpreting what the climate data from the ice core is telling us, we used a computer model, a climate model. This is a very fruitful way to let model and data work together, I think. And it's the only option we really have in the past, because we don't have all the data we want on one hand, and on another hand, we don't have access to all the mechanisms of the climate system. They can be really hard to derive from just one beta series, which is located, you know, on an ice sheet and close to the polar regions, in the polar regions. So that way, you know, using a model which gives you a more, you know, globally distributed picture of what's going on, and where you can delve into the mechanisms and say, you know, what happened, which, as you said, the ocean currents is a big issue here. But obviously an ice core does not directly record the ocean currents. So in this way, we can see, you know, we have some proxy data that, for example, the temperature will rely on where the moisture comes from. And when the sea ice and the ocean currents change, we can see that that forms a coherent picture that we then believe enough to interpret as a change in sea ice and ocean currents, even though it's not what we directly are measuring.
Well, some scientists have suggested that this Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, is the principal driver of changes on Greenland. But now this paper seems to cast some doubt on that?
I wouldn't say that. I think it adds a layer to the explanation of why the AMOC is changing. Because some people tend to think that the AMOC triggers everything. Like the AMOC is in the driver's seat and then everything else follows. I don't think anybody is really suggesting that the AMOC does not play a big role in these climate changes. But whether it's the trigger is still an open question. It could also be that atmospheric changes or sea ice is helping tip the ocean currents, the AMOC, which then feeds back on the climate system. So in terms of what the trigger is, I think the jury is still out. If there is a trigger at all, you could also interpret our new results in the way that you don't need a trigger, because it's the collective action of all these parts of the climate system, and the same ones every time, that creates the changes. And maybe if one starts to change, and that could just happen because of random. If the system has been in a cold state for a while, and there's some heat accumulating in subsurface ocean, this heat will be buoyant, and that at some point breaks through, and that influences sea ice. But maybe a wind anomaly or sea ice anomaly can also initiate this process once the system is close to being able to tip. So it's a very, I know it gets very hairy, but I would say that in terms of understanding what triggers these abrupt changes, we're really advancing our knowledge these years, but it's still not clear whether an outside external trigger is needed or whether it's the internal process in the system that just allows for rapid change between cold state and a mild state, and that this hunt for a trigger is maybe elusive.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Copenhagen. Our guest is Dr. Sune Olander Rasmussen. We are talking about abrupt radical warming in the Arctic, which happened many times in the last 100,000 years. And could it come again? We don't know. So would you talk to us, please, about the appearance of time lags in this process of abrupt warming? And there's a reason why I ask you this.
So a time lag between the different processes, or?
Yes. Are there time lags involved? Could something actually be happening even right now, but we're presently just stuck in the time lag, and we'll see it soon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can see, if you look at the different processes that played into these past climate changes, they were lagging by decades of each other, and they weren't always in the same order. So one process would start at one occasion, and then at the next occasion, about 30 of these, it would be something else that started, and then the other processes would follow suit. So there are time lags involved there. Then in this north-south communication that I mentioned between the climate of the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, there's also a time lag of around 100 years before the changes make their way all the way to Antarctica. So the climate system is full of these decadal scale lags, because you need maybe to build, you know, when you start pulling heat up north, you're taking it away from the southern ocean, from the oceans, the center of the oceans. So you need to build up a gradient. You need to build up a difference before this change will penetrate into, for example, Antarctica. It's very hard to get a signal to Antarctica. So this is where you get the biggest lag, 100-year lag, because you need to get across the ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns that that circulate around the Nautica and makes the Nautica very well insulated. So decadal lags or even centennial lags are very common in the climate system. And there, yeah, we see these, and they're also likely to be relevant today.
Well, Sunay, suppose we reach a tipping point where these various factors sway together towards a big change. How long would that take? Do we know?
No, I don't think we know. I mean, the combination will be different from what we know from the past because we're starting from a different setup. We're starting from an interglacial warm state rather than a cold state. But the processes, you know, in the past changed over, you know, the fastest ones over a few decades. And we could definitely expect to see that time scale involved. But there were also some of them which were slower. So it's extremely hard to put a number to it. But the decadal to centennial scale changes. It doesn't sound like much in terms of abruptness when you compare to a human lifetime. But when you compare to that, to the factors that changed climate on a natural, in the natural cycle before humans started to interfere, these are very, very abrupt.
Well, yes. I mean, it is possible that there could be a major change within a human lifetime, and that's pretty fast and pretty significant.
It's fast enough, isn't it? It's fast enough.
In a recent Radio EcoShock interview, we had Johannes Lohmann, a young scientist from Niels Bohr, and he explained that the speed of climate change can bring tipping points sooner than most models suggest. So we are in uncharted territory here. Do you think human-induced climate change will make another abrupt Arctic warming more likely or happen sooner?
More likely, definitely. And if it happens, then, you know, that kind of it gives you the question, the answer to the second question. If it happens and you've been increasing the risk, then it would also happen sooner, yes. Whether it happens is still an open question. And I think if we talk about reasons why we should try to mitigate climate change, me as a person, as a father of three, I'm a lot more worried about abrupt climate change than the gradual climate change. Not that I'm not worried about 2 or 2.5 degrees in 100 years, but I'm very worried about the abrupt climate change because in a densely populated planet, abrupt climate change can have a very large regional impact. And if that region is heavily populated, that will cause geopolitical implications beyond what I would like to imagine. So I think reducing the risk of something like that is at least as good an argument as the argument for reducing the amplitude of the projected climate change, the gradual climate change. So there, it's kind of two sides of the same thing, because by reducing the slow general global climate change, you're probably also reducing the risk of abrupt climate change. You can, analogy would be if you're in a boat and you know that the boat can tip over, you're not starting to dance around, are you? I mean, you'd like to stay a little bit still. And the more you learn about your boat as being unstable, the more quiet you want to be. So in with that analogy, I'd like us not to tip the boat, not to rock the boat too much. And one way to not rock the boat is to basically just, you know, try to get to reduce the climate change of all sorts. But in terms of what I'm most worried about as a human being, it's definitely the consequence about climate change rather than the gradual ones, which is bad enough. But I think the abrupt ones, they're so hard to imagine, and therefore, because we're only talking about risk assessment, it's really hard, and I don't want to say exactly what will happen because that would be pure speculation. But looking back at how ecosystems reacted when we had these abrupt climate changes in the past, it's bad enough.
Yes, these are not minor concerns. Look, I know that you don't want to predict, you know, what will happen because we don't know, but still, Denmark is a partner with the Greenlandic government, and we have to think that just on a very regional effort, this change, should it happen, would affect Greenland hugely, and it would also probably change the weather in Northern Europe, the UK, and even Denmark, wouldn't you think?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and of course, is it a problem that weather changes? Is the climate change? You know, it depends a lot on the people who live in the areas. And when these changes happened, I don't know the number, but I've heard estimates of that the population in Europe was like 100,000 people or so, and they were all migrants. They were hunter gatherers, and they would adapt and they would move around. You would have to move several hundred kilometers, if not thousands, in a lifetime to adapt to the changing conditions when these abrupt climate changes happened, which was, you know, if you ask the people back then, they would probably be at least mildly annoyed, but there was space enough. And people hadn't settled, and they hadn't, built large cities and infrastructure that was hard to bring with them. So I think it's really hard to use anything from the past as an analogy to how things will look if we have abrupt climate change in the future. Not because I want to be no fear-mongering, but we are a lot of people on Earth now, and a lot of people rely on their livelihoods from areas which are very densely populated and very heavily farmed, because conditions are good right there, and those areas could definitely experience serious change.
What still needs to be done to understand these risks better, and what are you working on these days?
Yeah, it's a super, super interesting and hard question, because even though we have 30 of these, it's still a relatively small number in terms of statistics, and they all come from a different starting point as what we have today. So we're trying to understand this both in terms of getting our models to capture these abrupt climate changes. The model we use for this study does capture the ones in the past, and we're trying to figure out to what degree we can trust it in also capturing similar changes in the future. It's a big job, and it's super difficult because these models are extremely expensive to run in terms of computing time. So there's a limit to how many experiments you can make. But that's one line of work. Another line is more theoretical work in understanding how complex dynamical systems with lots of parts that interact, how these systems change. And there's some theory, as you talked with Johannes Lohmann recently. He's an expert in that. So there are some general features in the behavior of these systems that you can derive and learn from. And then as a data person, of course, we go back and try to find data from all parts of the world, speleothems, so dripstones from caves, marine sediments, ice cores. Try to get a picture which is as comprehensive as possible, with as good spatial coverage, geographical coverage, and temporal coverage as possible, and also try to get these records aligned, so that we know not only what happened, but also tease out the finer details in how changes propagated. It's not something that's going to be done here at the end of the week. It's a long haul, and it's always already been going on for decades. But it is a climate system so immensely complex that this is something that's going to take some time.
Well, it's amazing we can do it at all, that science can retrieve the memory of Earth long before humans ever set foot on it.
Isn't it fantastic? It all comes back, from a Copenhagen perspective, it all comes back to Professor Vigge Damsgaard, who will soon be, who would have been 100 years old soon, who came up with this idea that isotopes capture the temperature of the past, and that you could go to the ice sheets and find old layers of accumulation. This was a very, very good idea. Keeps us busy still today. Of course, we have lots more methods and a lot of other types of measurements that we've added on. But the whole basic idea that the ice sheets capture in a very ordered and layered sense the precipitation of the past, and then we can go back and retrieve this and still find layer by layer, year by year, how climate changed well into the glacial. And I think this is what keeps me going. I think it's an amazing thing that it's possible, and it keeps opening up new questions that you can answer.
Perfect. From the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen, we've been speaking with geophysicist and Carlsberg Foundation Distinguished Associate Professor Sune Olander Rasmussen. Find links to the free access paper, The Anatomy of Past Abrupt Warmings, Recorded in Greenland Ice, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sune, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight with us.
Thank you very, very much for talking to me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In eternal darkness, under extreme pressure, sea creatures populate even the deep ocean. We know too little about them. Humans seldom venture there, and yet even there at the bottom of the sea, Human-made climate change will throw danger into the ecosphere. It is not heat directly, but something else. Here to explain is Dr. Andreas Ochslies. He is professor of marine biogeochemical modeling at the GeoMar Project, and that is part of the Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research, a government-funded science agency in Kiel, Germany. Dr. Ochslies has serious news about our long-term impact on ocean life, as published in Nature Communications in April 2021. The title is A Committed Fourfold Increase in Ocean Oxygen Loss. From Germany, Andreas Ochslies, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Many thanks for inviting me and for giving me a chance to present this recent discovery.
Yes, well, pretty well everything in your latest article surprised me to begin with. Until recently, many people presumed the world would keep on warming long after we managed to stop our carbon dioxide emissions. Can we really think that the news is better, that various forces stabilize temperatures at whatever the new normal becomes when we get to net zero emissions? Is that the new thinking?
Well, the news is perhaps pretty good for us living at the surface of the Earth, and also for creatures living in the surface ocean. So there we find, all climate models right now find that when we stop emitting greenhouse gases, then warming will stop very quickly. So that's the warming at the surface. But still, the entire planet is not in equilibrium. It's still disturbed. There's a lot of CO2 remaining in the atmosphere for hundreds and thousands of years. And this will perturb the radiation balance of the planet. And fortunately, this planet has an ocean. So the ocean is saving us to some extent. It is taking up heat. So far, it has taken up 93% of all the heat induced by anthropogenic man-made CO2. And that will continue for hundreds and thousands of years. So the ocean is slowly heating up. And most of the ocean today doesn't know that the Industrial Revolution has happened and that CO2 is accumulating in the atmosphere. The ocean ventilation is slow, so it takes thousands of years to transport the surface signal into the deep ocean. And for that time, during that time, the ocean will keep up heat and thereby stabilize temperatures at the surface of the planet when we stop emitting greenhouse gases.
Surface temperature aside, though, we know some natural forces are committed to change over the centuries, no matter what, as you say. For example, NASA predicts the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica. The melt of that is unstoppable, and perhaps permafrost thaw may already be tipped. But you find another unstoppable change in the deep ocean. Please explain the problem you set out to solve with new modeling.
Yes, so we know there are a few committed changes that are in the pipeline already and will continue for hundreds and thousands of years, like warming penetrating into the deep ocean, like glaciers melting, like permafrost melting. And in the model study we carried out, we looked at oxygen in the ocean. And this is a pretty recent discovery, that oxygen is declining rapidly in the ocean. So the ocean has lost 2% of its oxygen inventory over the last 50 years only. So if we continue at that rate, there wouldn't be any oxygen left in 2,500 years. And so this is a dramatic decline in oxygen, which is needed by all higher trophic level, by all fish, by all animals living in the ocean. And so this oxygen decline has worried us for some time. This is already, it's a pretty recent discovery that this is so rapid. It's only discovered in the last few years. And in this study, we now looked at whether there's any oxygen change in the pipeline. Most current climate models show that oxygen loss, what we call oxygen deoxygenation of the ocean, that it is increasing under all climate scenarios that we have over the course of this century. And so the question of this study was to investigate what will happen if we stop emitting CO2? Would deoxygenation stop, oxygen loss in the ocean stop, or would it continue? And the surprising finding of the study was that deoxygenation will continue for hundreds of years, and even if we stop emitting CO2, only about a quarter of the oxygen loss is realized by today. Three quarters are still to come. Even if we completely clean up
our act and stop emitting CO2 today, 3/4 of the oxygen loss in the ocean is already in the pipeline and will, according to our models, happen in the next few hundred years.
To be clear, in this study, you're not really focusing on the dead zones which pop up in the various parts of the world causing mass die-offs, including fisheries, are you?
We looked at the dead zones as well, but since these are usually pretty close to the surface, on the surface ocean, and we found that these dead zones, they do not show a large expansion if we stop emitting CO2. So that's maybe the good news, that if we stop emitting CO2 today, then we can also pretty quickly stop the expansion of the oceanic dead zones, which are, most of them are located in the upper few hundred meters, so that's what we call surface ocean, which is in close contact with the atmosphere on a timescale of a few decades, and then it equilibrates with the surface temperatures. And since surface temperatures in the atmosphere stop warming, stop rising when we stop emitting CO2, these changes in the upper ocean, where most of the currently exploited and valuable ecosystems for us live, those changes can be arrested pretty quickly on the timescale of decades if we stop emitting greenhouse gases. So that is good news of the study. There's a chance to stop devastating changes in the upper ocean, but there's little chance to stop devastating changes in the deep ocean, because that is, these perturbations are carried into the deep ocean with the general overturning circulation of the ocean and with the general slowdown of the overturning circulation, because the ocean is heating from above. So we put a lid of light, warm water to the surface ocean, and that is making ventilation of the deep ocean more and more difficult, because the stratification stabilizes. And there's not enough energy to really pump this lighter surface water into the deep ocean. And this is slowing down, and therefore less oxygenated surface waters reach the deep ocean.
The oceans don't heat up a lot in the sense that if we stick our finger in it, we probably couldn't tell the difference. But even marginally warmer seas will hold less oxygen according to physics. Why is that?
Well, all gases in water or in liquid dissolve, and there's some equilibrium between gas dissolved in the water, in the seawater, and the overlying atmosphere. When it gets warmer, the molecules move around faster in the water, and there's a higher chance for those molecules to leave the water, the sea surface, and to move into the atmosphere, because they are pushed around by higher temperatures more quickly, they move faster. So at higher temperatures, the ocean is losing all gases. And oxygen is one of these dissolved gases. And the solubility just declines with rising temperatures. That's an effect we know from sparkling water or beer or champagne, whatever you use, what you may have in your fridge. You have it in the fridge in order to keep the CO2 in the drink, in the liquid. When you put it, take it out of the fridge and leave it out in the sun, everything, the bubbles will bubble out and the gas will bubble out and it doesn't taste so well anymore. And that's happening with the ocean as well, and with gases in the ocean, the solubility declines with increasing, with rising temperatures.
But there's more than physics at work here. Really, it was through this article that I understood what biogeochemical in your title means. Yes, ocean chemistry changes because of more sluggish currents in the new climate state. But this deoxygenation comes from living things operating at depth. What sort of species are down there, and could they stifle as ocean chemistry changes?
Well, that's mostly bacteria. Like everywhere, that's the most numerous organisms on the planet. And in the water, we have bacteria that decompose whatever sinks into the water, falls into the water. All organic matter that is around is decomposed by bacteria. A few bacteria and algae in the surface ocean, they use solar light, photons, to do photosynthesis. And they produce organic matter, biomass, from solar energy. So that's a net production. And as a byproduct, they produce oxygen, like plants do and like trees do on land. So that's really a byproduct the plants don't need, they have to get rid of, and that's producing oxygen that we can then breathe and other animals can breathe. So this is the distinction. Plants do produce oxygen, but they need light. They can only live in the surface layer of the ocean. That's the upper 100 meters, perhaps. And the ocean overall, on average, is about 4,000 meters deep. So most of the ocean is dark, doesn't have any light. And there we can only have decomposers, so organisms that depend on material sinking from the light-lit surface zone down into the dark ocean interior. These are bacteria. They respire, like everything that is basically decomposing. That's what we see when we walk through the forest. A lot of things are decomposing on the ground. Same is happening in the water. And occasionally we have a fish or a higher trophic, some animals. We can, it could be jellyfish, could be sharks. They respire. They really need air, oxygen, dissolved in the water, to get their energy from it, drives the muscles, allows them to swim, to hunt, and to digest what they eat. So animals consume part of the oxygen by breathing, but most of the oxygen is really used up by bacteria decomposing whatever sinks down into the dark ocean interior.
It's pretty amazing. Our carbon experiment will reach even the deep ocean, where I presume conditions have been stable for a long time. Or should I presume that? Have they been stable for a long time? And would that stability affect species' ability to adapt to changing oxygen?
Yes, that's what we expect, that conditions have been stable for thousands of years. We don't really know. Nobody was there to look at these. And we even don't know in many areas what is living there today. But we know from a few experiments, like the sinking of the Titanic, that things are going on very, very slowly in the deep ocean. So how these shipwrecks are used as settlement area for new organisms, how the ecosystems respond to perturbations, how the species living in the seafloor, on the seafloor, are affected by such catastrophes. And from that, we infer that there are little changes in the deep ocean so far. So ecosystems there are used to very, very stable environmental conditions. And there are a few species that are hundreds of years old, so sponges in the deep ocean. They can't really move. They can't respond. They can't change to environmental conditions. And the deep ocean also is viewed as having a very stable temperature. So it's a huge volume of water, these 4,000 meters. And to heat up water or cool water, you need a lot of energy. That's what we see when we want to even cook our meal. It takes time to heat up water in our pot. And the ocean is therefore, with its large heat capacity, a huge thermostat, really stabilizing temperatures on Earth, but also providing a stable environment for everything living in the ocean. And this is now changing pretty rapidly, at least when it comes to oxygen. And this is so 10% loss in deep ocean oxygen, that's what we find from our models, would be a dramatic change in living and environmental conditions for species being around and having seen stable oxygen conditions, stable temperature conditions for thousands of years. So we have evolved in a stable environment. But now, in the next few hundred years, we'll see pretty dramatic changes.
You got me wondering, with slower ocean mixing, do other waste gases produced by living things remain longer in the deep ocean as well? Would that change biochemistry there?
So we expect that this rain of organic matter into the dark deep ocean will maintain relatively unchanged in the coming centuries. So that means the supply of organic material that can be respired will remain unchanged, and the oxygen consumption therefore remains unchanged. So I think bacteria, they will still see very, very little change. They get their food, and they still have some oxygen left, so that bacteria have a huge capacity to use even traces of oxygen. They are very small. They have a high surface to volume area, so a high surface area allows them to get even small amounts of oxygen into the cell. And they can always consume whatever sinks down. It's more difficult for fish, since they have to actively breathe. They have to pump water through the system in order to extract oxygen. And they have to breathe harder and harder, and they probably get less oxygen as well because the gradients across the system is weakened. So there's this 10% decline in the water will be felt by fish, as we experience when we climb a mountain. It's also a couple of percent changes in oxygen, but we have to breathe harder. And this is what fish will feel. They may not suffocate directly, but they have a disadvantage compared to other species around, and they can't spend enough energy to swim away from their enemies. So this is a huge pressure on the ecosystems that environmental conditions change, and particularly fish will feel it. We can't say who will be a winner or loser, but we can say there will be shifts, changes in the ecosystems because of these changing environmental conditions. Species tend to become smaller in response to reduced oxygen levels.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with our guest, Professor Andreas Oschlies. He is with the Geomar Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Germany. We're talking about deep sea life running low on oxygen as humans heat the world above. Recently, several guests cautioned global averages mean a lot less than regional realities, which could be greater and critical. You come to that problem in your article. Where would you expect deep ocean oxygen decline to be stronger?
We expect that will be felt first at high latitudes, the Southern Ocean and the Arctic. That's where waters tend to sink into the deep ocean. So that's where the signal, the perturbation we apply to the surface world will be transported into the deep ocean. That's basically the bottleneck that connects the surface world with the deep ocean. Sinking of heavy, dense waters. And this in the current ocean happens at high latitudes, Southern Ocean and the Arctic. And that's what we see in our models. These are the areas where the deoxygenation, the oxygen loss signal penetrates into the deep ocean. And these are also the areas where the relative changes are largest, where we expect about these 10% loss of oxygen in the deep areas of the Southern Ocean particularly, and the cold waters there just have a longer residence time. They move more slowly, and during that time accumulate a higher oxygen consumption from the bacterial and respiratory activity.
Andreas, when we consider all the warming in the ocean so far, say by 2020, what is the expectation for continued ocean heating?
That will also continue for hundreds of years in the deep ocean. So the surface ocean will stop warming whenever we stop emitting CO2. But the deep ocean is expected to warm up by several tens of degrees. That doesn't sound a lot. But in the deep ocean that has been stable for hundreds and thousands of years, such a temperature change will be felt by many organisms. So they will have to respire, breathe a little quicker to offset this increase in all metabolic rates because of the rise of temperatures. So this is what we see in the models. Heat is penetrating into the deep ocean. The ocean is continuing to absorb heat trapped on Earth due to greenhouse gases. And thereby, the ocean basically acts as a refrigerator for the surface where we live. The surface air doesn't warm because the ocean does the job of taking up all the heat.
And your paper examines marine heat and the oxygen balance until the year 2650, about 630 years from now. Why end there?
Yes, that's an interesting aspect. So we find that that's about the time the heat penetrates down 1 to 2,000 meters in the ocean. So it's a very slow process. So the ocean is deep, and it takes time for the heat to penetrate down. When that about 1,000 to 2,000 meter depth level is reached, then the ocean suddenly starts to pick up speed. The ocean overturning completely reorganizes, and it is basically kick-started again. And this warmer water from the Southern Ocean suddenly starts being not the light lit on the cap on the ocean, but it can penetrate into the deep ocean. And then we see a vigorous restart of the ocean overturning ventilation. So this is basically this effect that warmer waters in the end move a little faster than colder water. So if the entire ocean has warmed after these few hundred years, it will move a little faster and then in the end also start bringing new oxygen into the ocean. So we find that after a few thousand years, the ocean, if we can believe our current models, which are still very uncertain, but according to these models, the future ocean will be warmer. But once the heat has penetrated through the deep ocean, the overturning will be faster, the ventilation will be faster, and the warmer ocean will contain more oxygen than today. So that might be good news in the very long term. But of course, it doesn't help if there's an intermediate time of very low oxygen. So if fish die, are suffocated, or have to move away because of a lack of oxygen, they will not immediately come back when oxygen is. So whatever goes extinct cannot come back. And this is our worry from these simulations, that there may be a wave of very low oxygen conditions moving through the ocean before a future warmer ocean suddenly kickstarts again, turning over more quickly, and thereby also pumping more oxygen from the surface into the deep ocean.
To be somewhat brutally honest, if very deep sea creatures, both plants and animals, decline with less available oxygen, does that matter to life closer to the surface? Would we even know?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe we wouldn't know, really. So we have many oceans or many areas of the ocean, the Black Sea is a prime example. So the Black Sea doesn't have any oxygen between below 150 meters depth. About. So it's basically, from that perspective, we could call it a dead zone. But in the surface layer, of course, there's lots of life, fisheries going on, tourism, and it looks like a normal ocean. And only if you have your right equipment, oxygen sensors, and lower them, deeper than 150 meters, then you discover suddenly, there's no oxygen at depth. So there's a few thousand meters of water without any oxygen in the entire Black Sea. So from the surface, it might be pretty difficult to really detect what is going on in the interior. But of course, in the long term, it would have large effects on the biodiversity, on the gene pool we have on this planet. And we know from geological history that all major extinction events in the past, in the history of the Earth, they were associated with anoxic oceans. So oxygen loss on the ocean was always a critical element of these large extinction events. We don't really know whether that was always the cause, or just correlated with other things going on at the same time. But we do know that these deoxygenation events and anoxic, so complete loss of oxygen in the deep ocean, was always an element of the major extinction events on this planet. We don't know if anybody had lived there on the surface, whether they would have noticed it right away. But we see that after these events, the species change completely. There's new species developing, and those extinct will never come back, of course. So there are large shifts in ecosystems and in biodiversity. That's what we would expect also from such a wave of deoxygenation going through the ocean. it has the potential to permanently change what is around in terms of species, of ecosystems, and eventually that is likely to really penetrate also to the surface and then determine what ecosystems we will have there in the future, what future generations may be able to harvest, to use, and to feed on.
And as we sort of finish up, I notice that your work is pretty complex. It's wide-ranging. It's too much for one interview, but could you just mention what you do in your role as coordinator of the German research-funded study of climate engineering?
Yes, there we try to assess what options there may be, particularly in terms of removing CO2 from the atmosphere. So that's our main ambition, to really find out how can we remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Since we know that we cannot reach our climate goals just by reducing emissions, as already we've waited far too long to have a chance to reach climate goals with emission cuts only. And it's according to all the scenarios that go into the IPCC reports that we have available that assume lots of things about economics and population growth and social human behavior. All of these scenarios assume that we have to remove by the end of the century huge amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere, about the same amount that the US and China together have emitted until now. So it's not trivial, and we don't have a roadmap how to do this. And so in this program, we are exploring what could be done. So we can plant forests. That might be one way to suck up a little bit CO2 from the atmosphere. But probably we have also to resort to additional measures, such as putting alkalinity or putting basic alkaline material into the ocean, changing the ocean chemistry, counteracting ocean acidification in order to allow more CO2 entering the ocean. So the ocean in the end there is likely to be a reservoir, carbon reservoir, that can help us to restoring atmospheric conditions in order to reach the climate goals. But there may also be purely technological measures, like artificial trees that absorb CO2 via chemical waves from the atmosphere, things we use in submarines or space stations today. But these could be engineered, it's at least theoretically possible, to build these on a large scale to clean up the atmosphere. They need a lot of energy, they're very expensive, and they may not look beautiful, so there are many aspects. And that's what we study as well. So how will society respond? What are societal concerns? What are ethical issues? And what are legal issues? Since things will be pretty big, so large changes will occur in order to remove these required amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. And governance of this is really critical. So we have to think this through before we do it. And we need, in the end, a global agreement, even if we want just to plant trees to remove the required amount of CO2. It's about afforestation the size of Russia. And we don't right now know what is going on. We will change the color of the planet. We will change evaporation, the hydrological cycle, rainfall patterns. And so even planting trees on such a large scale is nothing a single investor or even a single state should be allowed to decide on their own. I think it will require international agreements, and we have to know the possible consequences, the risks of all of these large-scale processes before we do them, in order to avoid political and societal conflicts. And that's our main worry. There are many ways natural sciences tell us how to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. So that's not witchcraft or not, there are many processes how to do this, but the amounts are so large and the measures will be so large that we have to make sure society can agree to things and can do it in a responsible way.
From the deepest sea bottom to the complexity of the social reaction to climate change, we've been speaking with Professor Andreas Oschlies. Find links to Andreas and his new article, A Committed Fourfold Increase in Ocean Oxygen Loss, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andreas, thank you for sharing this valuable time with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for keeping your ears on reality in this fast-changing world.